Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for April 18th, 2024. And many topics to cover tonight. This one is very interesting. In the Bogatyr mine region in Kazakhstan, in Russia, there are mines there that are immense. These are mines that are pit mines that have been basically dug out over the centuries. And of course, the majority of this digging has been going on pre-World War II. But you look at this thing, and it is solid coal. Now, you have to ask yourself how this happened. And to somewhat explain this, imagine, I don't know how many of you have ever been to the open pit mines in the Mesabi Range in Minnesota. These are vast holes cut out of the ground that were used to remove iron ore. And so when iron ore comes up out of the ground, it's oxidized, it's red. So there's this red powder dust all over everything, all over the houses, all over the roads, all over any equipment, all over everybody's cars. You know, it's part of the snow in the winter time. It's everywhere. And I had some relatives that actually lived up there, so we'd go up and visit them. And it was like, you know, and the first time I ever went to see the open pit mine, I was a little kid. And that's when the iron ore was running out, and they moved to a lesser content ore called taconite. And they said there's enough taconite there to last forever. But the open pit mines, the Mesabi Range mines, the Hibbing and other areas in the northern part of Minnesota, were really the sources of iron for the entire world through World War I and World War II. And I'll just give you a little kind of a story here about how these came to be. But first, what I should do is talk about their size. And when you're a little kid, everything's big, you know. But, you know, people are big. My first recollection of my grandma, one of the grandmas, was that, you know, I just remember socks because I was short, you know, and that's what grandma looked like, you know, as my recollection right now of when I was maybe 3 years old. But, you know, when you're little, everything is big. But I remember as a pretty young, maybe 5, 6, 7 years old, first time I saw the Mesabi open pit mines, you know, and you walk up to the edge and you look out, and it's like looking into a hole that's just immense in the ground. I don't even know how to describe it. It's not like a crater on the moon or anything. It's just, and then little roads going down, and you can see the vehicles, which are enormous vehicles, land-moving, iron-moving vehicles, going down this little road all the way down, spiraling down into this open pit. So at any rate, they are just enormous. But the story about how these were discovered, there was a pair of brothers, the Merritt brothers. And I always used to think their name was Mesabi, but Mesabi was just the region of this, like the county or some region, Minnesota. So it was the Mesabi region, but the actual brothers' name were, the name was Merritt, was their last name. And they discovered the first part of like an outcropping that was above ground of this iron vein that ran through this entire region, just basically solid iron. So you can imagine something back in the primordial days of Earth slammed into Earth, you know, with high iron content. And, you know, became part of the land. And, of course, that very much affected the magnetic fields up there. So compasses don't work in that part of the world. We had to learn as little kids when we were scouts how to find things, you know, and find north, etc., without a compass. Because the compasses didn't work. We had to depend on other things, other mechanisms for finding directions. But anyway, be that as it may, the size of this pit was what I'm getting at, and I want to relate this back to the coal mines. in Kazakhstan, in the Bugatyr, I'm not sure if I can say that correctly, Bugatyr region of central Russia. The coal mines there are similar. And so you go, well, okay, coal, let's face it, is not from dinosaur bones and fern forests. It's just not. And what really happens is with the big tsunamis that occurred during a planet passing by Earth, these are ocean tsunamis. What they do is they just take up like a bulldozer. They take all of the material and they scrape it. And then if there's a pit or a side of a mountain or whatever, it just piles it all there. Now, we know from Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania coal fields, where Ignatius Donnelly, who was the lieutenant governor of Minnesota eventually, grew up in the coal fields of Pennsylvania. And what, you know, in digging out the coal and using it, that's what powered the initial Industrial Revolution. The trains and the factories, everything were covered, you know, by, you know, the electric power plants, etc. The heating of homes, everything was by coal in the early 1900s. And that's why there was so much pollution, because there was no regulation, and the coal is, you know, pretty dirty. But just remember that coal is not decayed plant matter that's then solidified. Coal is active living plant matter that's been completely bulldozed up by these great tsunamis and then dumped someplace, and with the pressure, the water is pressed out and all that's left is the carbon, you know, that was the basis of the plant. And so that's what coal is. If you take a piece of coal, it's like shale, and you can see layer after layer after layer the imprint of the fern leaves or whatever is in there, and now and then they'll find something like a ring from a person in the middle of a coal field, indicating that there were actually people living there at the time when these big planets came by. Okay, so anyway, you wonder how this vast amount of coal got to this one point. And this is the answer, is that the tsunamis brought it and dumped it and kept dumping it repeatedly into this pit area. And then, you know, thousands of years, tens of hundreds of thousands, who knows how long, millions of years potentially later, man comes along, discovers it, and starts digging it out, and there's just no end to it. It just keeps going. And we know that these tsunamis happened repeatedly, because in Pennsylvania, you will find a layer of coal, a layer of gravel, a layer of coal, a layer of gravel, etc. And this is what is described by Ignatius Donnelly in his book, something that everybody really should read, talking about Atlantis, the antediluvian Atlantis and the antediluvian world. Because what he describes is in the United States, as the people came across the United States and across the Great Plains, they encountered the remnants of a great flood. There was no question about it. The washes, the amount of material that was deposited, or tree trunks, etc. And the word on the street is that by the year 1900, that is after the great 1800s expansion west, all of that material had been consumed by man, either in burning fires, maybe making a construction out of it, whatever they did with it, it was gone. So that allowed the ivory tower professors to proclaim that there was no flood, or to question it, when in fact everybody back then in the mid 1800s knew that there was a great flood, and historically they knew that there had been a great flood. So this location, these coal mines in Russia, you know, and that's a major source of energy, and it has been for literally now pushing maybe 100 years. I have a video that's on my, it used to be linked from my webpage. I don't think there's a current link to it. But basically one time I was in the middle of, I think it was in Wyoming, and I'm on this long stretch of road, and there's a bridge. You know, the road is straight that I'm on, and all of a sudden it makes a swing right up over a bridge, over to the other side of these railroad tracks, twin set of railroad tracks, and then continues. And just as I got there, this train starts coming under the road, under the bridge that I'm on. So I stopped the car. There's nobody around. Hadn't seen a car in, you know, in hours. So I stopped right on the bridge, take out my DVD camera, put it on the bridge, and filmed this train going by. And there were, like I say, two sets of tracks. So the train is going one way. It is full of coal. And I stopped counting after hundreds of cars. I literally stopped counting the cars. They're full of coal. And then pretty soon, coming the other way on the track, is a train equally long with no coal, empty. So wherever these trains were going, they were going to some electric plant, delivering the coal, and then coming back and getting more. And these trains just keep going all day long and all night long, burning coal to feed the immense appetite for electricity in the United States. Okay, so coal, another thing about coal is that it sequesters CO2. And so when you burn it, you combine the oxygen with the carbon, and it releases carbon dioxide into the air once it burns. That has to go someplace. So anyway, coal is like direct drive, taking carbon dioxide that was sequestered from the atmosphere and putting it back into the atmosphere. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether this is good or bad. But one thing is clear, that Earth really has a very minimal amount of carbon dioxide. We really need more. I should tell you a little story here also. I joined, you know, I'm a finalist in an X Prize. It's called the Water Abundance X Prize, no secret. It's one of my things I spent a couple of years on pursuing. And anyway, I joined another X Prize. It was funded by Elon Musk. And it was, the whole purpose was to develop technologies that would remove and sequester carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And I, with the wing generator and with, I won't go into the technology that was associated with the wind energy systems, but based on the wing generator, to sequester carbon dioxide, get it out of the atmosphere, and keep it there. And so I developed a system that would do that. But the problem is, I realized in developing this process and looking also at what others, I think hundreds of other teams were involved in this, that there were teams that were able to do this. We move, and I forget the exact goal of the XPRIZE, to remove millions of tons of CO2 and sequester it, keep it out of the atmosphere. There were people mixing it in cement and making tennis shoes and all kinds of other applications where they were sequestering CO2 from the atmosphere. And I took on a different role. I'm not going to go into detail here, but what I realized is that, number one, you can do that. You can build machines. You can build machines and incorporate technologies that will remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And the goal, of course, would be to bring it back to the levels of CO2 before the Industrial Revolution. So back to what they say, 1880 is the time prior to which they started burning a lot of coal in the Industrial Revolution. So the goal would be to get back to the point of 1880 carbon dioxide level, which, by the way, is kind of goofy, because when the dinosaurs were here, there was vast vegetation on planet Earth, and they had to have an extremely high CO2 content to fuel the growth in which the dinosaurs lived. There is not a single place on Earth today, even the Amazon jungle, as dense as it is, there's not a single place on Earth today that would support dinosaurs, the big ones. Why? The vegetarian ones, that is. And that is because there's not enough CO2. And so it really turns out that if you have a lot of CO2, you have vibrant plant life, and an Earth would be a much healthier planet with more CO2. But the problem with burning coal or other things is the direct heating. And this is something none of the little woke bobbinheads running around jumping up and down talking about global heating due to carbon dioxide, this is what they fail to realize, is that the real issue is the current expulsion of heat, direct drive into the atmosphere right now. That is the real problem, and that's where real global heating is coming from, not from greenhouse effect CO2. So the end result is that we should not be burning this. And I'll get into a little bit later, I'm going to be talking about an advent of geothermal producing hydrogen. So that's where this is going. I want to talk about the advent of hydrogen being generated by geothermal and other sources of energy creating hydrogen. Okay, so just to follow up on this, now when these large planetary objects come by Earth, and of course they are in the form of a comet, because they are discharging the solar capacitor, creating a cometary, visual a cometary, and physically a comet, there are many other effects, but including the gravitational effects of creating these tsunamis, these tidal waves, that create coal. Now, this happened, remember, a number of years ago, it might be as many as 10 years ago, there was a volcano and then followed by an earthquake, followed by a tsunami that was generated from Sumatra. And it swept across the Indian Ocean and west to Madagascar. It was the tsunami that went far inland on the southeast coast of India, that whole coastline killing, they really don't know how many people it killed. A lot of people died there. Because that tsunami was unexpected. And by the way, that's one of the major issues that has to be addressed in the United States is the Canary Islands. That's why there are coal fields in Pennsylvania, is because of the tsunamis that come from landslides in the Canary Islands across the Atlantic Ocean. And of course, everybody in the government is running around jumping up and down over wars in Iran and Israel and Gaza and everything else, the Taiwan, whatever, and nobody is addressing the real issues. These are the real issues, boys and girls. Okay, so anyway, the other issue when these large planetary objects come by, sometimes we draw off material from the tail and sometimes we don't. So the times when there is, especially hydrocarbons, and of course water is a main component of comet tails, but the hydrocarbons, basically naphtha, oil, and that if the Earth does get close enough to the tail where we are bringing in some of that hydrocarbon, then that's impregnated into the oil, I'm sorry, into the coal, and makes what we call wet coal or high, it's like high octane coal. It burns much hotter because it has the petroleum, the hydrocarbons in there, which form in the comet tail. So we have dry coal and then we have wet coal, with wet being in the form of petroleum. Let me just do a little quick review here, because there's so much misinformation about where petroleum comes from. And then you have the abiotic people, in other words, biotic is a term implying from biosystems, from plants. So abiotic oil would mean not from plants, and the concept being that somehow oil forms in the ground, deep in the ground under high pressure. Well, let me tell you something. The majority of oil on planet Earth is very near the surface. It never got any place near deep in the Earth. There are veins which are, they've discovered 18 miles down. That's how far they can drill now. But the vast majority of oil that has been discovered and utilized on planet Earth since it was first used in modern historical reckoning around 1200 AD has been on the surface or very near the surface. And so the whole idea of abiotic oil is just it doesn't explain anything about where oil really comes from. So that doesn't work. And the reason that came about is because it became clear that fern forests and dinosaur bones were not the cause of oil, because you have oil fields under the ocean. Where were the fern forests, etc., under the ocean? Where were the dinosaur bones? And of course, that myth was instigated by the Rothschilds, who took over the oil industry early on and had to make up an excuse for where it came to make it sound like it was some kind of precious commodity, that there was a limited amount of that, of oil. And of course, there isn't. There's vast, vast amounts of oil, and that's because it comes from outer space. It comes from the tails of comets. And you can see that the hydrocarbons in the tails of comets. You can see the nitrogen-hydrogen compounds. You can see the carbon-hydrogen compounds. The nitrogen-hydrogens are like the ammonias and nitrogen-based hydrogen compounds. Carbon-hydrogen compounds are what we call petroleum, basically, and the ancients talk about that, the rain of brimstone and fire and naphtha. And so anyway, then the other hydrogen compound is oxygen, with hydrogen in that primary form is in the form of water, and that's the primary component in comet tails. I've been misquoted as saying, since there isn't water on the comet nucleus, there isn't any water in the comet tail. Well, that's ludicrous. Of course there's water. There's abundant water in the comet tail, but it's coming in to the comet nucleus, not going out. And why is there not any water on the comet nucleus? Because on the small comets that man has visited, those ions come in and they're neutralized because of the high density of electrons around the nucleus, because it is negatively charged, because of the excess current. The discharge is, the excess current is in the form of electrons, and so the end result is that when the ionized molecules that are just forming, when they come in into the region of the comet nucleus, they're neutralized and they blow out with the solar wind, because the comet nucleus does not have enough mass to hold it. The large comets like Hale-Bopp have enough mass to hold the material, and it then grows into a planet, but those are very rare. Okay, so back to the idea of oil. The oil that is on planet Earth came from the passage of Earth through comet tails. Very simple. And like I say, the other associated event is the tidal wave. So you have this coal building up, this massive amount of material, this plant life, and it's deposited in these caverns in low spots like the Bogatyr mines in Kazakhstan, Russia, along the eastern coast of the Appalachian Mountains, in the places like Pennsylvania, the coal fields of Pennsylvania, etc. And that's why sometimes there's wet coal, very high octane coal, and dry coal, which does not burn as hot because there's no petroleum in it. That's where all of this comes from. And anyway, I was talking earlier about the tsunami that came across the Indian Ocean. It did a lot of devastation in India. But the point of me bringing that up to round out that thought, to come bring back and tie in there, is because that tsunami went all the way across the southern Indian Ocean to Madagascar. Madagascar is kind of a mini continent out there off the east coast of Africa. And in real time, that tsunami came in, scooped up all of the plant life, and dumped it on the side of the eastern side of the mountain range, then central Madagascar. So we see that happening in real time. There is proof of that. You don't need to draw a pretty picture in a textbook to understand what's going on there. It is reality. Okay, so a quick mention here. Some very interesting things are coming up here, and they might be in place by the time this show airs, because, you know, my webpage has undergone tremendous advancements in bringing it up to date. Because before it was an old-style web page, it just, it needed an upgrade. So that's been underway, and it's a huge website. It's like, 15 gigabytes or more. Now it's actually more. But you can go there, you can order products, the individual ebooks are there, and they download immediately upon ordering, things like that. So vast improvements. And so one thing that's coming up here that I'm very happy about is I'll be able to do daily postings on the webpage. And these will be news briefs, very short. I just put one there today. It's not actually, it might be posted now in the blog section, but dealing with, I'll talk about it in a minute here, about the Tennessee, the state of Tennessee, working a law through its court, it's through its House and Senate and up to the governor for signing to ban chemtrails. So anyway, very interesting. But anyway, my point is that I'll be able to post daily on my webpage and put up articles, things of interest, and then give my unique commentary. And you can go back there on a daily basis to see what's going on, what's hot in the news, etc. Okay, now, I got scolded, not scolded, but just kind of reminded, let's put it that way, that I was going to do a follow-up to the eclipse. Remember the April 4th eclipse that went through Texas, the 8th. Okay, I'll get it straight here. April 8th eclipse that ran across the United States. And I did three shows prior to the eclipse dealing with that issue. And then after the eclipse, I just kind of dropped the ball and didn't talk about it. And that's because, in a sense, it was really a big nothing burger. I guess that's the best thing you can say about it. Because, boy, did the... this is what's interesting, is the science news media. You would think that during an eclipse, let's go back 100, 200, 300 years, what is the most important scientific event relative to an eclipse that has happened since Isaac Newton? You know, and there have been lots of solar eclipses since then. Well, it would be absolutely the Arthur Eddington experiment to verify general relativity, which I've said before, he faked the data. You know, the reality is that when he went to the island, and this is to be expected, they had very poor weather in the Atlantic, and then his buddy, his sidekick Dyson in Africa had similar situation. They did not have pristine weather. And remember, this is an event that only lasts for 4 minutes. And so if you don't have really good weather, you know, the little bit of cloud cover is going to make things disturb your ability to take data, especially when you're trying to pick out stars. Now, the sun is completely blotted out, but the corona gives off a lot of light. And then you have these stars that become visible, but right next to the sun. It's got to be very near the sun where these star patterns are that you're looking for. So, be that as it may, they did get data. They were not able to analyze it on site because the best thing to do would be to use the same equipment at the same time, say the same day, either the morning before or the evening after at sundown. And this would be in December, so it would be like the evening after dark, just after dark when the sun goes down, to take a picture of this region of the sky. And then in the morning also the same region of the sky before the sun comes up, because that gives you the other half of the visibility of that region around the sun. But they didn't do that. And so anyway, but that's okay, because the position of these stars could be measured with the same equipment and then determine the movement of the stars based on comparing those two photographs. And they first of all, they didn't have very good data, but they did have data. And I have seen the data from the Eddington experiment, and the stars are moving all over the place. They're moving sideways, they're moving towards the sun. The vectors are big, they're short, there's very few of them that are actually moving away from the sun. So what did he do? He took a statistical sampling. Now, I've taught statistics for physics, for engineering, statistics for even for business people. I've taught statistics, so it's something I happen to know quite a bit about. And that is not the way you do statistical samples. You don't cherry pick the data and take those and then weight them more heavily. If you took the sample of data that Eddington had and did a statistical analysis, a true statistical analysis, you would not verify general relativity. But they made this announcement. Everybody assumed they did it correctly, and that's a big mistake, because in science, you need third-party independent verification for any scientific claim. Okay, so that's the way, and that's what I've said about, for example, the NASA moon landing. People say, well, you don't believe NASA went to the moon. I said, my official statement is that's an unverified scientific claim. NASA claims that they went to the moon, the Apollo program, but you need third-party independent verification. Remember Pons and Fleischmann? These were two guys that said they discovered cold fusion. And believe me, I know a lot of university professors, every one of them, and chemists too, had some kind of experiment going on in the back room trying to figure out cold fusion, how to do it, how to make fusion occur. They had some kind of deal going. Everybody did. But the story with Pons and Fleischmann is they had some experiment set up they were working on. They were hopeful. They go out to lunch, and they come back, and the table is like their beaker of whatever it was had melted through the table. So they go, wow, we achieved fusion. That because that's the only thing that explained the damage that was done in their laboratory through a metal table. And so anyway, they made the announcement, we have achieved cold fusion. But they didn't know what the reaction was. They didn't know what happened. And they could not reproduce it. So very shortly after, because this, first of all, it went viral. And of course, this is in the days before the way the internet can go viral today. But it went viral in the, you know, the media, the medium of the day. It went viral. And then people started coming back and say, well, what did you do? You know, we want to reproduce it. The hopes were very high, and then it was like everybody was trying to do what they had done, and nobody could reproduce this, including Pons and Fleischmann. So they lost face. They lost face big time. But the level of scrutiny does not apply to certain people and groups, like NASA. How does NASA get to make a claim that it did something as monumental as go to the moon, and nobody else in, you know, these, you know, better part of almost a century now, a lot of decades, has not verified it? All the people that have been around the moon, etc., nobody has been able to verify that they, in fact, went to the moon, except for the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, where they sent back these pixelated photographs. Your cell phone could do better. Your 1970 cell phone could do much better than those photographs. But anyway, back to the issue that Eddington faked the data. And then this brought on the rush. Once again, going viral, if you can imagine 1919, you know, the newspapers, you know, general relativity proven. And Einstein, in as early as 1905, had become an international figure. He won the Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect. Other things he had done were very important, very major discoveries, etc. And, you know, so this was just like a shoe-in. And so everybody believed it. And then the statement came out, well, only super intelligent people would understand general relativity. And it was, I mean, in the day, it was extremely advanced, the mathematics, the Minkowski mathematics, the understanding of curved space and integrating the fourth dimension of time into a matrix of mathematics. All of this was very advanced. So, and remember that much of general relativity is true. It's this part of bending of light around the sun that's where it stumbles and falls, and Einstein knew that. Okay, so anyway, this is somewhat the background, but why would the scientific community in this event, April 8th, 2024, when everybody's supposed to be scientifically astute, why was it never even mentioned? I'm the only person that I'm aware of that even talked about this. And I get, you know, people send me stuff all the time. So if they see something that I might be interested in, they'll pick up on it and send it. And, you know, I'd somebody somewhere would see something in the news on somewhere regarding the Eddington experiment. Not a peep, you know, quieter than a church mouse, as they say. They don't want to touch on this topic. I just saw it in the last day. Somebody sent this in. There was a union of concerned scientists that met in England. These were cosmologists, and they ranged from people who were really against the Big Bang up into people who were defending the Big Bang. And the idea was to have an open discussion about issues. Now, the issues, let me just make this very clear. The cosmological issues are all related to data that has been interpreted relative to the Big Bang. And now when you have an explosion, say such as the Big Bang, or say you have fusion at the core of the sun, these are systems in which in the system with core fusion of the sun, which is wrong, the X-rays are the energy comes out of the fusion reaction as X-rays. And so what happens, there's a thing called the random walk. And if you go right or you go left, there's statistically you could go right or left. And so when the X-ray is absorbed in the same process, in the fusion process at the center of the sun, this is the story anyway, then it would take literally millions of years for that energy to work its way from the core region of the sun up through the atmosphere and out to the surface. And the end result is that it should be absolutely constant and smooth on the surface of the sun. Well, and that's what everybody thought until finally there was equipment that could actually view the surface of the sun, and it was anything but smooth. And to every time they look at it with different instrumentation today, even, they find more fracturing, more structure, let's just put it that way, of all kinds. Tornadoes racing across the sun. And by the way, that's the thing that got the Russians really interested in my work back in the early 90s, is that they were seeing tornadoes race across the surface of the sun, and they're going, what is this? It's a tornado. My work explained it as being the same cause of tornadoes and cyclonic storms on Earth, and that's what we were actually working on, the University of Novosibirsk. The atmospheric scientists there were interested in my work because of the causality of hurricanes, cyclonic storms, basically tornadoes, cyclones, waterspouts, etc. So at any rate, back to the Eddington experiment. It was, you know, Eddington, in a sense, put himself up on a pedestal. And he was then considered, he was a physicist, bona fide physicist, but it put him on a pedestal above everybody else for the rest of his life. And if he would have really related the truth of the experiment that he measured, that the light was bending in all different directions, it was definitely bending, but it wasn't bending according to general relativity, but not in the radial direction, and not by graduated amounts, less and less as you get farther away from the sun. It was all over the place. And so instead of publishing the true data and saying, no, this disproves general relativity, he did the opposite. He did the thing that made him exclusive. If general relativity would not have been proven by his experiment, he would have been a nobody. Nobody would have ever repeated his name. But if he proved that general relativity was correct, whoa, big time stardom. And to this day. And so anyway, as you know, I have a, in fact, I have this new release on my webpage. It is called Eclipsed, the New Cosmology, and it's a course that you can take. It's on my webpage for sale. And it basically teaches you about measuring different things with data that's given in the set to disprove not only general relativity, but cosmology in general. But this group of scientists in England that just met, they were talking about large arcs and concentration of matter in the universe. The only problem is that the redshift does not imply distance. And so the yardstick that they're using to measure and map the universe is totally distorted. It doesn't have anything to do with, imagine looking out into the universe, and we have our perspective here from Earth. Everything is out there. And the thing that you're using is the redshift to determine how far away this stuff is. But the redshift is all distorted because the redshift has nothing to do with distance or things moving away from us. It has to do with the level of fusion and non-uniform electric fields that are created by the fusion engines in the atmospheres of these stars, galactic nuclei, etc. And so the universe, it's like a lens that's all distorted. And imagine you were a navigator. Say you were Columbus and you were trying to navigate off to the new world and your map was all distorted. You know, that's what's going on. Absolutely absurd. And, you know, it's so convoluted that these people cannot step back in not even a little bit and understand that everything they've done is incorrect. Everything. And they want to save bits and pieces. Each one has his favorite little piece of the pie that he thinks is correct. And so it's really a Tower of Babel situation, truly a Tower of Babel situation. And so anyway, just to follow up with the April 8th solar eclipse, I did not have any response for people sending in data. And it's really difficult to communicate with people. It's really, really difficult. I had some activity. We had a comet event here a number of years ago, and I had some people trying to work on that. But it turned out that, remember the comet that was going by Venus? And we finally did get some data there. It was came out of the University of Arizona, and it was slipped out. It was some graduate student or some low-level person that really didn't know what he was doing. Slipped that data out, and we found a big interaction between this comet and Venus. It was named after that joker, works at the University of Arizona Astronomy Department. The comet was named after him, and I forget the name even at this point. But as it approached and passed Venus, was very close to Venus, bam, it discharged, and that comet took a few orders of magnitude increase in size and in activity. So it proved my point, exactly what I was saying, that comet was going to interact with Venus, and in fact it did. Okay, so I just want to spend a minute here talking about Tennessee. Now, this went through the House. Now, the government of the states is similar to the federal government. You have the House, where bills typically start. And they're drafted, they're revisited, they go into committee, they're rewritten, and then they come out. And finally, that opens up to the floor where everybody gets to comment. And then, of course, they vote on it. Well, the vote on this was, 24-6. And what they voted on was to prevent chemtrails from being sprayed over the state of Tennessee. Well, this brings up some really interesting points, and the question is, who has control of the airspace over the states? Right now, the FAA, by whatever authority they deem, has control of the airspace. And this came up also a couple of years ago when Richard Branson was coming in for a landing from one of their space ventures. They took off from the New Mexico spaceport, went up to low Earth orbit, and came back down. And when they dropped down a little bit below their flight plan for coming in for a landing. And that was considered dangerous, and the FAA shut them down, etc., did an investigation. And, of course, if you're coming in a glider and you come in too low, probably not a good plan, because you can crash, and kill a bunch of people. So I can see why the FAA did a little bit of investigation into that. But the question is, and I raised this with some of these people involved in the New Mexico spaceport, is does the FAA have jurisdiction over the airspace? When you look back at the Constitution gave certain rights to the federal government. Anything not specifically stated in the Constitution was then rolled over to the states. A recent thing came up, controversial, over abortion. And Trump said that this is a state's issue. It's not something that the federal government should be involved in, neither at the Supreme Court level or at the legislative level or at the presidential level. It's something that, and it's just a matter of who has authority. And the same thing turns out to be true for airspace. Who controls the airspace above a state? Is it the federal government? They don't have jurisdiction, literally. But they assume that, and there's all kinds of agencies, like the Environmental Pollution Agency, which I call it the EPA. They license pollution, have been for decades, years, centuries, and all of these other federal agencies that mandate, Homeland Security. Who gives them the authority to have jurisdiction? Anyway, that's one issue, but. The other issue here is, for the first time, at least that I'm aware of, and that other people are aware of, this is the first time that somebody is actually in a government admitting that there are chemtrails. As part of the legislation, they're preventing them. Well, obviously, they wouldn't pass a law if there weren't something going on. I don't know how much chemtrail spraying is going on in Tennessee. However, Florida is big time. California is big time. Other states are big time. I personally was one of the early pioneers in the whole chemtrail thing. Back in the early, that was a long, long time ago. Right around the year 2000, before a lot of people were even out of grade school who are talking about it now. But the other question is, who's doing this? Who's spraying chemicals? And you've had people that, how can you be president of the United States and ignore that your entire country is being sprayed from airliners? And is there any question about it? Of course not. Of course not. They have the photos, and they have the, where Boeing is making airliners specifically filled with tanks that are for spraying chemicals into the air. And of course, they're using them. Who is exactly behind this daily spraying of the United States? And where is the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration? Where are they in all of this? Even the EPA. Is somebody spraying harmful chemicals into the environment? Do they have a permit? Hello? And then it gets back to the other question, like I said, who has jurisdiction? Well, what if the federal government takes Tennessee to court, to the Supreme Court, saying they don't have jurisdiction? It could end up into some funny business. But then the government would have to be admitting that they're doing something that they believe they have protected rights to do. Spraying chemicals on you. So anyway, this is, it's like the pin going into the bubble. It's the balloon. It's just beginning to break, but, you have other so-called progressive states like California, where there's huge, huge daily amounts of spraying. Some of those people actually think that by spraying, they're going to cool down the earth and stop global warming. Jeez. I mean, it's just nuts, just nuts. Anyway, I want to spend a few minutes here talking about geothermal. This is the new buzzword in hydrogen. As you know, I'm working with the wind generator to bring about hydrogen. It is the only solution. But of course, there are people who talk about hydrogen, but the reality is that the big corporation, the Shells and the big corporations, the petroleum corporations, want to invest in hydrogen, but what they're doing is converting either methane or natural gas, components of natural gas, and breaking out the hydrogen that way, or there's methods of transportation using ammonia. Can you imagine a ship? Imagine a ship the size of an oil tanker and the devastation that happens when oil is spilled. Imagine something that size with ammonia going into the sea or going into a body of water, into the St. Lawrence River or something like that. Can you imagine the ecological damage of that amount of ammonia going into the environment? Absolutely. I mean, it would kill. Oh, I just unbelievable. So anyway, but the new buzzword is in geothermal. And one might think, well, it's free energy. Maybe it's kind of like you just drill a hole in the ground, you get the heat back up, you convert some of that heat into electricity. That electricity makes green hydrogen. But that's not really the case because, as with everything, just like nuclear, they're calling nuclear green. It's the most horrifically, talk to the people that live near Chernobyl. I just saw this guy, he's a really good YouTube channel, it's called Veritasium, and a lot of really good stuff, but he was presenting Chernobyl, that they're building, when Chernobyl went off and had the meltdown, they built a temporary cement case around it, and so now they're building another one. They have to build it nearby and then slide it over there on top of it. But it'll only last 100 years, costing billions of dollars. And the lifetime of the radioactive material in the reactor is in terms of millions of years. And so it'll be millions of years and it'll still be relatively the same amount of radioactive material in that location. And the building they're putting around it is only going to last 100 years. Oh my goodness, anybody that says nuclear is green, excuse me, but no, you need a good trip to the woodshed, buddy, or Missy, or whoever's saying that. Nuclear is not green. And what they're saying is it doesn't emit carbon dioxide, but it pours, belches huge amounts of heat into the atmosphere. It ain't green. And by the same token, for the same reason, geothermal is not green, because a good portion of the energy is lost. It goes directly into the atmosphere, probably about well over 70, probably close to 75% of that energy that's coming up out of the ground goes directly into the atmosphere, which is heating the atmosphere. And that is the issue. We're just heating up this planet on a daily basis with enormous amounts of, just burning fuel, and that cannot continue. And I think too that the sun, the solar energy, is heating up the earth, and I think we're involved in a form of heating that we've never seen in hundreds and hundreds of years. So I think there's multiple contributions here because the temperatures are rising. But remember also, as I talk about in my weather book, that the Earth is coming out of an ice age, and this is the normal warming pattern. That when you have an ice age, which is Earth passing through the tail of a comet, you have the water influx, the glaciation, because it gets very cold because the sun's light is blocked out. So you have this influx of water, you know, the freezing, and then then the comet passes by, Earth is returns to its normal situation with solar activity. And then what happens? Okay, well, the Earth starts warming up, but very, very slowly, because it has this white reflective material all, you know, almost all over its surface. So it takes a long time for this process to begin. But once it takes hold and it starts, it's like an exponential increase in the heat content of Earth. And as these snow, these ice caps melt, remember when I was a kid, the Great Montana glaciers were still there. There were big glaciers out west. They're all gone in my lifetime. And that was before the massive use of energy that we're using today. The reality is that the direct heating of the atmosphere is the culprit, and people are too stupid. They're running around jumping up talking about carbon dioxide. That is not the issue. It's direct heating of the atmosphere. How else can you say it? I don't know. But anyway, geothermal, for any reason, is bad because you're taking latent heat that is in the Earth, releasing it into the atmosphere and causing further heating of the atmosphere. The only solution for hydrogen is wind, not solar. Solar will not work. Three-blade wind turbines simply will not work also. And by the way, this big pork barrel legislation called the Inflation Reduction Act is putting trillions of dollars into the pockets of people like GE and Siemens and Vesta, who are selling this crap three-blade wind turbine technology that does not work, was designed not to work. Wow, things messed up. I won't even talk about political situations here because that's really screwed up. There's a lot of people talking about that and analyzing that. But yeah, the world is probably in one of the biggest messes, you know, top to bottom, wall to wall, in 100 different ways, 1,000 different ways than it's ever been in history. That's all I can say. So, okay, well, just about out of time here. I just want to mention that the sale, we left the sale up on the MR5, the best deal. It's $1,250, which is a huge reduction. That's like literally $1,000 off for the MR5 and the UV sterilizer package. And that's going to be going away because we're just extending it because of requests by a couple people. And remember to go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, see the new webpage. Look at the products there, the books, the CDs, the DVDs, everything, and working on my what I call my legacy products. And I'm out of time here. We'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.